originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I am joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and to those of you tuning into our website as well at www.horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have given everything to the sport. If you're able to help, please visit their website. That's www.pdjf.org. So I'm very excited about our guest tonight, someone I looked up to for advice during my own career. He was born into a family of racing, the son of a jockey, the grandson of a trainer. He went on to win multiple graded stakes victories, 7 of those aboard the very talented Frisk Me Now. And more recently, he has spent time as a track steward. With 2,246 victories and over $41 million in earnings, it is a pleasure to introduce jockey Eddie King. Eddie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Christina. Nice being here.
Such a pleasure to have you on, and can't wait to hear your story, Eddie. It's been a while since I've seen you, actually. Saw you back out east at Parks when I was riding out there. But you're not from the East Coast, Eddie. Tell us where you grew up.
Oh, I grew up in a small town in New Mexico called Raton. It's actually 7 miles from Colorado and about 80 miles from Texas. And born in Ruidoso, so I'm a southwestern boy.
What was it like growing up out there, Eddie? As I mentioned in the introduction, you were born into a family of racing. Did you grow up around horses your whole life?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we would, My dad wasn't really in the picture, so we went with my grandmother up until we had to start school. And that's how we settled in Raton. But every summer, we got to go to the racetrack. It was usually Denver, and then, holidays and stuff like that would go out to Phoenix where my grandmother was at. So, yeah, I lived just off the backside of the Mesa Park. So when we weren't, at the racetrack where my grandmother was at, we were jumping the fence and running down the backside.
I love it. Did you help her in the barn area as a small child?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was the greatest thing. Back then, horses were a little different. So the horses were our babysitters. We spent all day at the barn, and a lot of times we'd nap in the stalls with the horses and, clean the stalls best we could at that size. Pitchforks and the muck baskets were bigger than I was, so... But we always made a great attempt, and then our job was basically to mix the feed. So we, not only fed the horses, but we got to dine with them, too. So.
I love it. Now, were you an only child, or did you have brothers and sisters?
No, I had, I've got 2 brothers. I've got one that's older. He's just a little over a year older than I am. Then I've got a younger brother he's about 7 years younger than I am. But they're both big boys. My older brother... He's always been 2 or 3 times my size.
Wow, so you were really the only one who had any type of potential to be a jockey then.
Oh, yeah, correct. And neither one of them really ever had any ambition to be around the racetrack anyways. They, aspired to be other things.
And did you know from a young age that this is what you wanted to do?
I was in the womb when I knew I wanted to be a jockey. So that's all I ever wanted to do. So I never had a job till after I retired from racing.
Well, and I read this article, Eddie, that stated that you used to ride horses up and down the mountains and just all over the place.
Oh, yeah. You know, we used to, we were breaking horses and things like that, just out for pleasure. But mostly when you're breaking horses, you find those that were really a little bit unruly, you just hit them to the mountain and ride them until they got tired. Then they seemed to understand what was expected of them, what you were asking of them. And it made it a lot easier to bring them around and make racehorses out of them.
And how old were you when you started breaking the young horses?
Oh, it was in my teens. Early mid-teens, 14, 15 years old.
And so you try to fit all this in while you were going to school, I'm sure. Were you a good student, or were you just primarily focused on the racetrack?
No, I wasn't a good student, and I should have been. Didn't find out till years later that I should have been focusing more on grades as opposed to just having a good time and running wild, which... a lot of us young kids that grew up around the racetrack were all the same. We spent more time around the pool tables and just being kids as opposed to focusing on what we needed to be doing.
Did you play sports in high school?
I like to play football, which, that didn't work out too well once I got past junior high. Yeah. Everybody seemed to grow up, and I didn't. So, every time, and I play a defensive back, so those guys just kind of run over the top of me, which is okay. I learned when they got to high school, that's not what I wanted to do. But I loved playing baseball.
So you're naturally athletic then, and you were breaking horses, you said, as a teenager. Were you galloping horses on the track as well at that time?
Oh, no, they wouldn't let us on the track. And since everybody, they watched, everybody knew who you were, watched out for you, so there was no way you were going to sneak up on the track. But we had a lot of pastures, and we had a lot of fields. I mean, we had miles and miles of nothing to prairie grass and cactus to run over. So that's where we did all of our stuff at. In fact, we would know. They used to put us on the racehorses. We were just, wasn't even in school yet. But like I say, those horses were different than they are today. They had jobs in the wintertime. My grandma trained for a guy named Max Peterson, and he was a rancher in Colorado. So after the summer, after the racing season was over, they would take the horses to the farm, and they used them with the cattle. So they would work all winter, and then in the summertime they'd go back to the track. So they were broke well enough that we could ride them around the barn area. So, a lot of times there'd be, half a dozen or maybe a dozen of us, and we'd all be riding the thoroughbreds. And I can always remember my grandmother saying, and the other guys, now don't you be going down that backside and racing those horses, because they're going to run next week. Well, that was open season for us. We would just... As soon as nobody could see us, we were off to the backside, and we'd be racing those horses as best we could.
Well, they were fit, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's interesting. So they were race horses in the summertime, and in the wintertime they would go to the ranch and work cattle. Yeah, you don't hear of that nowadays, for sure.
No.
But good horses to teach you on, I'm sure.
Now, it was a blast.
Your grandmother, we've mentioned several times. What did she teach you from the very beginning, knowing that you wanted this to be your life? What kind of advice did she give you?
Oh, God, she's never really vocally said anything. It's mostly in her actions about how you work with the horses, what you do with the horses. Being a horseman is probably more what I learned from her than anything that she could tell me.
And I'm I'm assuming we talked to several guests here on the show who started from the ground up working with the horses in the barn area and how important that actually is when you go to ride, because you understand the horse and how they're physically made. And I'm assuming for you that had to be a big benefit as well.
Oh, yeah. And it's also with how you communicate with them. I mean, what you do, what the response is to what you do, and how you respond to what they do, you know, so that somewhere along there you meet in the middle, and it helps them be better, and ultimately helps you be better.
Jockey Eddie King joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Eddie, you're going to school, not really focused on school because you love to be around the horses. You're helping your grandmother, and you're learning to ride. And when did you decide you were ready to actually take out your license?
Well, I didn't actually start riding until I was 20. I there for a while, probably my senior year in high school, you know, we were doing some crazy things. It was, you know, exploring my, you know, I don't know. We were just partying, you know, got a little out of control, dropped out of school, went back to school, and finished in the fall. And I finally decided, you know, if I'm going to become anything, and I had to make a choice of what I wanted in life. And it was right back to the track. I mean, worked under the barn and lived with the horses there for a couple of years. And finally decided it's time. If I'm going to do it now. And, I was at that edge, too. It was just a little bit bigger than most riders, so I had to try to get my weight down. And like I said, everybody knew who you were, so I actually had the stewards and racing officials saying, no, you're not ready, get a little bit more weight off and stuff like that. So finally I was 108 pounds, and I said, that's enough. I can't take any more off of this frame that I have. And went ahead and started, and I had, you know, a lot of people willing to give me a shot, so I jumped in.
So you got down to 108. How did you do that? What was your schedule like with weight and eating and exercising?
Well, yeah, it was mostly diet, and I must have run probably 100 miles a week. I was just constantly running, you know, sweating and watching what I was eating, and then
100 miles a week. Wow.
Yeah, and then I, did some diuretics, which that didn't last long, as I found out it was doing me more harm than good, so got away from that. Did my best to stay away from those my whole career.
So, Eddie, do you remember your very first race?
Yeah, I remember my very first race for a guy named Mark R. I couldn't tell you the horse's name, but he was a big chestnut horse. Wasn't worth much money, but I can remember him. I can remember the way the race ran and where I finished.
Describe it to us.
Well, this horse, he was, you know, of course, like many times, he was 99-1, and he hadn't even ever got in the race the whole time. That he's 6 or 7 times that he'd run before, and so Mark, he put me on him, and he said, just go have fun. And the horse actually ended up running fourth, got beat about 4 or 5 lengths. So he was a massive improvement from what he was his previous starts.
And how did you feel after the race? Were you exhilarated? Were you tired? What were you feeling?
Oh, I was pumped. No, I was excited. You know, like I say, I've been galloping a lot of horses, working a lot of horses, and running all the time. My legs were a little bit rubbery when I was heading back to the jock's room, so definitely wasn't as fit as I thought I was.
It's funny. When I rode my first race, I thought the same thing. I thought I was so fit, and then you actually ride your first race, and you realize you're not as fit as you thought you were, but nothing like riding races to get fit enough to ride races. I mean, that's, you know, you're using every muscle in your body, but... So, Eddie, where was that at where you rode your first race?
I rode my first race at Centennial Park, which was in Littleton, Colorado at the time, which it's not there anymore. They tore it down. Now they race out of the Arapahoe Park.
And then did you continue riding there at Centennial for a while?
I come back the next summer. We went to Phoenix for the winter in, I guess it was around December. Ronnie Hansen was riding out there, and he was had his apprenticeship at the same time. And he went down right in front of me on a horse for Walter Ding and ended up breaking my wrist. So I was off for a couple months during the wintertime, and then got back to riding, had a great winter, and then went back to Denver that summer and was the leading apprentice.
Wow. Did you have a good agent working for you at the time?
Yeah. I don't know if I ever had a really... I've had one or two top agents, but not really. You know, it's one of those things you get out and you get on every horse you can on in the morning. You know, a lot of times you get on 20 horses in the morning just to create your business. And then you just get lucky, you know.
So you had a great year with the bug, or the apprenticeship, as we also call it. And you eventually lose the bug. Did you find that that transition was hard for you?
A little bit. You know, my business fell off some, but, you know, at that time I was really trying to find my place, where I was going to be, how, you know, making decisions on where I wanted to ride and, you know, how I wanted to proceed and, you know, trying to listen to, you know, everybody's advice, which everybody's had an opinion. And so it was, it was a little tough.
And where did you eventually decide that you should go?
Well, I guess it was one of the people I rode for during the summer at Centennial was a guy named Bruce Gould. At that time, he was you know, I'm not going to say he was old, but he was in his 70s, you know, mid to late 70s. Anyway, he decided to sell off his whole outfit, and somebody bought the whole outfit, and they went to Nebraska for that winter and asked me if I wanted to go, and I said, well, you know, why not? I hadn't ever been there, and ended up going to Grand Island for the winter. And, that's actually what took me into Nebraska for a couple, 3 years.
Eddie, I think it was Nebraska you mentioned when I called you a couple weeks ago. We were hit with really cold weather here in Kentucky, and I mentioned something about that, and you went on to reply with, well, in Nebraska, we used to gallop with our shirts off when it was 10 degrees. And
I mean, there was one winter there, it was so cold. I mean, you know, being as flat as it is, the wind blew every day, but we really had terrible weather. You know, a lot of snow on the ground and below zero temperatures. And, you know, we horses need to train. We had to get ready for the race meet. And finally, you know, when it would get up to around 10, 11 degrees, we would go out there with just, you know, just a shirt on. Just your body was so used to that bitter cold that it was a heat wave at that degree. So it's not that I want to do it now.
Yeah, no.
It seemed to be a lot of fun back then.
Yeah, I don't think I'd like that too much. Definitely not. And what would you do? I mean, I remember riding a Penn National myself in the dead of winter, and that was pretty chilly up there, but nothing like Nebraska. And so did you have any tricks that you learned along the way to deal with the cold when you were riding in it?
You know, just don't ever stick your hands in the water. So like everybody would tell you, you know, because we either rode with cotton gloves or no gloves at all. And when your hands be so cold, you'd have to stick them in ice water and get, you know, to give us a chance to go out for the next race. It just, there was, equipment wasn't near what it is today, you know, as far as how it reacts to the body and, you know, wicking of the moisture and everything like that. We had silk pants and pantyhose. That was our long johns. And then, God, I don't know.
Pantyhose, that works. That's pretty good, too. It keeps you surprisingly warm. I remember using those as well.
Yeah.
But you went from one cold place to another, and you went to Chicago for the Hawthorne meeting in 1984, I believe.
Right.
I looked that up when I did my research. And so why did you decide to make the move to Chicago?
Well, it was just a good transition. I was writing for, Donnie Kayvon Hill at the time and a few other guys that were come from Nebraska, and that's where they would spend their fall at the Hawthorne meet. And so we went in there, and Terry Wallace was actually my agent at the time, which, you know, everybody from Nebraska knows. And Hot Springs, he was the announcer down there and did the radio show and things like that. So Terry and he came out with me, and we just had a tremendous meet. I think we ended up third leading rider at Hawthorne that winter. And then Frank Kirby asked me to stay and ride the sportsman's meet for Hondo Ranch. So that's how I ended up staying in Chicago for the years.
Wow, third, the first year you arrived. That's very impressive. And what did you think of Chicago when you first arrived? I'm sure it was a little bit different from out in the Southwest.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't know what to think of it. The first time I ever came to Chicago was the middle of the night. We're going down to Kennedy, and it's long traffic. Got a pickup and a house trailer on behind me, and it was just... I thought, well, I might as well turn around and leave. But we stuck it out. And all in all, I enjoyed Chicago. It was all right. You know, it was just the craziest atmosphere around the racetrack. You know, everybody I seemed to know was a criminal. You know, we had thieves and they called them Goombas. And, you know, everybody had a little something going on that was... maybe not legal. Just seemed like that was all people around the racetrack. You know.
Yeah, that's interesting. What about the jocks room there? What was the jockey colony like?
Oh, it's a great colony. I mean, not a lot of people thought too much of Chicago. I mean, now they're in Arlington Park. That's where, you know, they said all the best riders are at. But, you know, there was just some great riders at Hawthorne, and then in the Sportsman's Park, Hula Villas was riding at the time, and then Ronnie Hansen showed up at Chicago. I can't remember all the people that were there, but just the Louvier brothers both were there, and they were both really good riders. Yeah, it was just a really good colony, and they were tough, and no matter what anybody said, they were tough riders. To ride Sportsman's Park was amazing. If just to see how tight them turns were and how fast you could go in and around them. It was a blast.
Yeah, what was that? That wasn't a mile track, was it?
No, actually, when I remember, it was only 5/8.
You
know, it was sometime or another, it was only a half-mile racetrack, and they just stretched it out as opposed to redesigning and making bigger turns. They just stretched it, so you had the half-mile turns with a little bit longer stretch run. And, they could... you know, before I got there, I never saw it happen, but they said horses end up on Laramie Avenue and going out towards Cicero Avenue.
Oh, no.
But you sure didn't want to blow the turn because there was no place to land except out under the road.
Wow. Well, and you have to, with those bull rings, as they call them, you have to be so good breaking out of the gate. Did you find that you were already accomplished at that, or did you have to learn how to be even better at it?
No, you just had to. I guess I was always had a knack of getting away from there in good fashion. It just, I guess it's something, a gift you're given. Because I've seen really great riders couldn't get away from the gate. But that being said, they were still great riders. So it's just. But even at Sportsman's Park, you didn't have to be away from the gate so good. You just had to plot your course and kind of stick to it and, you know, find the best way around there, which was always the shortest way. Of course, you know, you get on the rail and hopefully everything worked out for you and you could get through.
Eddie, how else would you prepare for a race? Would you watch replays? Would you pay attention to how the track was playing out? What would you do?
Well, you get to watch the replays, but they can only tell you from the day before. It's not, you know, a lot of times now they've got these replays, you can watch races from years past, but basically just read the racing form. And then because they would tell you how, you know, everybody knows that they tell you what the horses have done. So you could find out kind of where you should be in a race and where everybody else should kind of be. And then you'd study everything. You'd study what the racetrack was doing that day. You have to know your riders. So you'd study your riders, you know, the whole time that you rode. You'd watch everybody's got a stick or a habit that they do. It's something they do every race, every day. And I don't care who you are, every rider has a little something that they do. And you just have to find out what that is, pick up on it, and try to capitalize on it, and incorporate that into a race.
What was your habit? What did you do? What was your style, I guess?
Probably the thing that was probably the worst thing I ever did was... And it wasn't a bad thing. It's just that I wasn't always maybe as aggressive as I should have been. I always kind of let the horse kind of find his way around there and then get him to finish, which, you know, a lot of the old trifecta bettors and superfecta bettors, they always loved me because I was always in the money in those races, and it's because I gave a horse a shot. But maybe I should have been winning those races if I was more aggressive, but, you know. But hindsight, I would never second guess it.
So you're more of a come from behind rider then?
Well, that's what I always preferred, but you know, probably 90% of the people that I was around all said I was a speed rider. So I don't know.
Give me the horse, right? And as long as I win,
yeah, that's it.
Whatever works.
Yeah.
What about grass and dirt? Which did you prefer?
Oh, like everybody did. Grass was always so much nicer to ride over, and it was more like the bull ring. You know, you had to kind of ride it like a bull ring, no matter what size the track was, whether it was Belmont Park or, you know, at the old Hawthorne, their course was only 3/4. You ride just a little bit different than the main course, so I liked it. And then you could go out with one pair of goggles, which is always great. You know, you didn't have all this stuff pressing against your head.
Not getting caked with dirt, right? That's always nice.
Right.
Well, and describe a little bit briefly before we go to break here, Eddie, describe briefly the difference as far as the horse's reaction time on the grass as well. It's a lot different, really, than riding on the dirt.
Well, yeah, because if they get more comfortable, their eyes are open. They can they could probably see a little better what's going on than... I don't know, when you ask them to run, that switch is a little quicker, they get a better footing, and they accelerate a little faster than they would, I'd say, on the dirt.
All right, folks, we will continue our visit with jockey Eddie King after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Eddie King. And Eddie, before we went to break, we were talking about your move to Chicago and riding there at Hawthorne and Sportsman's Park. And how long did you ride that circuit for?
Well, I rode from 84 to, I think it was the fall of 89, the winter of 89, then I went to Garden State Park in New Jersey.
Why did you decide to go to Garden State?
It was kind of a real emotional time for me at the time. My grandmother, being raised around her and at the racetrack and everything like that, she passed away. So, I was a little upset. And then had a good friend that here in Chicago that got killed. Like I talked about some of the bad guys, he had a business. Was a pallet business, but that was just a front for something else. But anyway, he stole the truck. Somebody else wanted the truck. They had a shootout. He ended up dead. And between that and my grandmother, I said, I just got to get out of here and find someplace different. So I thought I was going to go to New York and talk to a couple people. And, after talking to him, we decided to stop in Garden State and see where we go from there.
Did you feel like that was a good move for you once you arrived there?
Yeah, it was. I went to Garden State and hired a guy named Sam Manzi to hustle my book. And we're going to Garden State and ended up being third leading rider there that first winter. And they didn't even show up a month later or something like that. But, no, it was a good move. And then from there, ended up going to Monmouth Park and kind of spent 23 years out there after that.
So I guess you liked it then, 23 years. Wow.
Yeah. It was the greatest thing to go to the East Coast, which, because you can go anywhere. I pretty much stayed right there in the Mount Laurel area of New Jersey, which is a suburb of Philadelphia. I was able to live there and stay there the whole time. And, I could ride 12 different racetracks and probably within about 2 hours of the house, so it was a great deal.
Yeah, that is a beautiful thing, because the life of a jockey, so much of the time you're basically a gypsy and you're moving all over the place. But the Mid-Atlantic region definitely does have a lot of opportunities with so many different racetracks. Which was your favorite place to ride?
My favorite place was Monmouth. There's just something pretty special about it. I guess I'd always been attracted, even when I was first started. We had some riders come from the East, and they'd bring their forms. And I think at the time there was two. There was the Daily Racing form and then another print. I can't remember what it was called. But started reading the racetracks, and there was just something about Monmouth Park that drew me to it. So once we ended up there, it was kind of where I wished I'd always been.
Yeah, Monmouth is a beautiful place, and helps the beaches right next door, too. It's a nice place to spend some time, for sure. And, Eddie, let's now talk about really nice horse. You had the opportunity to ride to multiple stakes victories. Frisk Me Now, who was trained by Robert Durso. Tell us how you got that mount.
Well, I had been riding for Bob. I rode most everything that he had. But just 1 year, it was just kind of an amazing year for Bob and the outfit and for me. But he had three or four young horses, and there was one in there that, which I can't even remember his name now, but boy, he was really exceptional. He was fast, and he's really quick away from the gate. I thought he was a ticket to bigger things. Actually, he was owned by Richie Maloof, which Eddie Broom, I think, trains for him now. But there, Bob had this one colt, and he had the exercise boy. The exercise boy kept telling me about this other horse. He said, this is the one you got to watch for. But he was just always kind of I'm not going to say a big dummy, but he was just a little bit slower to come around. And so we end up going to Florida for the winter, and there's something happened with that horse. The lights came on. You could just tell he was starting to turn into something that was different than what we'd seen all summer long.
And when was it in an actual race that he really proved himself?
Well, there was two races that really impressed me more than anything. I knew when he was turning the corner, we were at Calder. In both races that he'd run over there, he just got annihilated away from the gate, and pick him up and get him moving again, and just seemed like we were always in the jackpot. I mean, he never gave up. He always kept coming on. He ran third both times there. And then we were over at Gulfstream Park, and Bob decided to work him on the turf one morning. And I think the dogs were up, and he worked 5/8 and 59. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just friggin' amazing. And then we come on after that a week later, and he wins the Danica Hutchison, which at that time was the first prep for the Kentucky Derby. That was in 97.
Wow. Well, and then obviously he went on to run third, actually, in the 97 Florida Derby. And did he actually run in the Derby?
No, he never did. There was just, even though he was coming around, he was just never on the same level as the horses that were running that year. You know, there was Captain Bodget and Pulpit and Silver Charm and, those horses. He was just never on that caliber quite as yet. But he was getting there. It was just a slow process.
Well, he did run fifth in the Preakness that year. You mentioned Silver Charm, of course, won that year. And was that the first year you rode in the Preakness?
Yeah, that was the only time I ever rode it. And that was such a mess that year. Anybody that can remember, the horse that was on the outside, C.C. Lopez, rode him for Al, somebody out of New England. Anyway, that horse took almost 20 minutes to load.
Mm.
So in you riding races, and if you've ever had to stand the gate a long time, which probably a lot of rides the same thing, if you get them in there long enough and they take a deep breath and relax, the whole demographics of the race changes.
Mm-hmm.
And right when they finally got ready to load, that horse walked in, Frisky took a big old deep breath and just relaxed. And mm-hmm. right at that moment, our race had changed. Mm. And it did. He went okay, but it just wasn't what you was expecting when we went over.
Well, he did go on to do great things, Eddie. You guys, you ended up winning the 97 Pennsylvania Derby. He didn't just win it. You literally annihilated the field. He won by 8 that year, which was pretty impressive. What were you thinking that day?
Well, it was one of those days I knew he was doing good. I knew he should win. I just want to stay on. Because if you see somewhere in there, we were one of the races where we did not finish. It was the Long Branch, something like that. I actually left the gate, and the buckle from the rain come off. The rain dropped. The inside rain dropped, and he was such a big, long horse that he could never reach up and get the hold of the head stall to get, to get around there. So I just had to let him have his way. We went about three-quarters of him on the racetrack, and the outrider come picked him up. So... Mm. That's all I didn't want to happen.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that had to be a scary experience with the rain dropping to the ground, having barely any control whatsoever. But yeah, he was a pretty impressive horse. What was he like to ride?
Well, he was good to ride. He liked competition. He liked to be down inside. He didn't mind getting roughed up a little bit. In fact, he really thrived when he was laid on by another horse, things like that. Somebody just race riding. He thrived on it. It made him a better racehorse when there was, a little tussle in the race.
He's very competitive, yeah?
Yep.
Again, you guys won 7 graded stakes together, including the Pennsylvania Derby, as I mentioned, the Ohio Derby. What would you say was the most impressive victory of his? Was it the Pennsylvania Derby or something else?
Probably the Suburban. Mm. Suburban Handicap at Belmont.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then probably the biggest disappointment was the Whitney at Saratoga. When, it's not many times when you get on a horse and you know them and you say, they will have to run to beat this horse today.
Mm-hmm.
Or when he runs. And so he's in the Whitney, and my wife and I, we drive out the night before. And when I go out to the track that morning and go to the barn, I see Bob standing out there and they're holding his legs. And all four of his legs are blowed up. He had some sort of reaction to the medication they put on when they did him at night, when they put his bandages on. And he was so blowed up that his skin was actually cracked and seeping. So Bob worked on him all day, spent a lot of money buying aspirin and turning into paste and, putting it on his legs, trying to draw him down. And he went out there that day. He ended up running fourth, probably only got beat about, I don't know, 5 lengths, 5.5 lengths, but he wasn't that same horse that when I left Monmouth Park, I was going to ride. No. So that was probably my biggest disappointment of any time I ever rode him.
No fault of his or yours, just horrible circumstances.
No,
my gosh.
Circumstances.
Would you say he was your favorite horse that you've ridden?
Oh, I don't know. He was fun to ride. I don't know if he was quite my favorite. Probably a horse that, Who's the Cowboy? He was a Jersey bred for Jerry Sleater. He was fun to ride because, he'd come from off the pace, and when he turned it on, he was one of those horses you had to have a place to go, or he was just going to run over him.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many times we were flying and running by horses so fast it looked like they were stopped.
It's the biggest rush. I love that feeling just coming from way out of it like that. And what did you two accomplish together?
Well, he won multiple Jersey Bred Awards. He ended up making over $1 million, after I quit riding. But just in the time that I rode him, we made about almost $750,000.
Wow.
Running right there at Monmouth Park and the Meadowlands. He's just a fun horse to ride.
Juggy Eddie King joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Eddie, you mentioned Who's the Cowboy went on to win even more money after you retired. So, let me ask you now, when did you retire and why did you decide to do that?
Well, the last horse I rode was March 24th of 2009. And I had some injuries that were, creeping up, old injuries. In 07, actually I had a horse flip over backwards and it landed on my shoulder. And when I hit the ground, I knew I was in trouble, that something went wrong. Anyway, it was the last race I rode that day, and it was the last day of the weekend. So I was able to go to the doctor, get a cortisone shot, and things like that, and nurse it throughout the next year, which was 08. But sometime during that time, I just woke up and decided I was done. Didn't want to do it anymore. But the main reason was the shoulder. I went in and ended up having 2 surgeries. And the last one, they found out that my rotator cuff was torn, had some minor damage, bicep was split, and I had tendonitis in it. So there's just a lot going on with the shoulder.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it would have been tough to come back from that. Did you have, you mentioned the horse flipping over on top of you. Any other bad injuries, any spills?
Oh, I broke my back twice and my neck once, but and multiple broken legs and collarbones and stuff like that. But really, they say I never really was hurt bad. I mean, probably my shoulders were the most painful, but I can't say I was ever hurt, Never hurt bad.
I'm sure the audience right now is is shaking their head because, I mean, it sounds like you broke your back twice, your neck once, broken legs. That sounds pretty bad to me too, but, you know, obviously came back from those. Did you ever, during any of those injuries, obviously the shoulder, you did decide it was time to retire, but any of these bad previous injuries, did you question coming back?
Oh, there's always that day or that moment sometime in there that you say, you know, maybe I should do something different. But then just as it comes into your head, it goes. You know, there's nothing, like I say, I never had a job. So I was living the life.
Mm. What was it exactly that kept bringing you back? I mean, was it just the rush? Describe it, Eddie, what it was.
It was, you know, going fast and taking chances. It was just always so much fun to get up, go out to the racetrack in the morning, get on the horses, and just to smell that place every day was, you know, I mean, I was raised around it, so just this kind of, it's something you can't explain. You know, if you've got a passion for something that you absolutely love, you know, like my family always comes first, but my family was always second behind what I had to do. Mm. So if that makes any sense, I have no idea.
No, it
but
does.
I just loved it. And, and like I said, I love to go fast and take chances. And just the feel of these animals was just amazing.
You mentioned your family. You've mentioned your wife. And tell me about your family.
Oh, well, there's five of us. Our nucleus is five. We've got three kids, two girls and a boy, and like I say, my wife. Right now, all three of the kids live in Omaha. I don't know how they ended up there, but that's where they live. And my wife and I are living outside of Chicago. She actually works for United Airlines. She's done that since, I guess, 88 was the first time she started working. It was either that. Like I told her, you know, I was coming home every night and she would ask me about how this person was, how my day was. I've always been the one to leave the racetrack at the racetrack. And finally I told her, I said, you know, we're not going to be married very long unless you get a job. Gave you something else to talk about. So she started working for United Airlines and she's working on her 29th or 30th year now. So,
well, you guys have been married a long time, so it worked out well,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, working on her 35th year.
Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing.
I'll say. I never thought I'd be married to somebody over 21 years old. Look at me now.
How did you guys meet?
It goes back to the first year we went to Grand Island. I was staying in a place called the Valentine in you know, a motel and had little apartments in the back. And I was staying there and and I was rooming with the guy. Anyway, he got fired and moved on. My wife's brother was living with his dad there, and he asked if, you know, go ahead and split the rent with that place that I had. And I said, sure, why not? And somehow or another, his sister and the whole family came around Easter time, or just before Easter, and they come to town, and I, you know, who knows? Anyway, he had to go out. He wanted to go out on a date, but his date, they wouldn't allow her to go out unless she doubled. So he asked me if I would double with his sister, and so it's that was history. I mean,
that was
we're still
sister.
Together.
I love it, Eddie. And you mentioned your three children. Did they have any interest in pursuing anything at the racetrack?
Well, I think my girls probably had this fleeting thought. They both were really small and really had great hands and a great seat on a horse. And but like, you know, and I spent the money on the jumping and the English riding and all this, you know, and I've told them, if you ever say racetrack or that you want to gallop horses, I'm not going to pay for any more riding lessons. Well, they couldn't stand themselves. After about 2 years of riding lessons, they both said that they wanted to come to the track and gallop horses. So that was it. I wasn't going to have any of it. Because, you know, I mean, as a girl, you got to say, the racetrack is nothing but a bunch of scumbags. And growing up, I was one of them scumbags. it's just crazy. I didn't want to see part of, and it's probably the same thing everywhere. I just said, I don't know about it. But I knew how the women were treated at the racetrack, and I didn't want my girls exposed to it.
So what do they do now?
Oh, my kids?
Yes.
Where we're at? Yeah. My oldest, she's his mom. She's raised, got three kids and takes care of them, sells a little real estate on the side. And, the youngest, she's into marketing. She just graduated last year. So, whatever marketing is, she's looking marketing for a medical company of some sort. And then that's about it. Then I got my son there, which he's working for a company that sells stone, those that they put on the front of houses and things like that. But oh well, they're all doing great.
Glad to hear it, Eddie. And now I want to go back to your retirement. You said you retired March 24th, 2009. And was it hard for you? Did you regret that decision you had made? Did you miss it? What were your thoughts immediately following that?
Oh yeah, I was torn. It was, to finally say, you're done, you'll never do it again. And it was, I wrestled with it for a short time, not long. Then you start searching for what else you want to do with your life. I started pursuing that, which first off, I had to get the shoulder to heal, which that took a long time. And then, thought, well, let me try this agent thing, which ended up not being so good at it. I hated working for writers, especially with ones that didn't have a very good work ethic. You want somebody that's going to come out and do the job when you set work, you line work up for them to come out and do their job. And come to find out there are not too many of them that were like I was, that went out and worked every day. So I decided it was probably to do something different after that.
Yeah, that's when I knew you, Eddie, was when you were an agent out east, and that's understandable. And did you find also maybe watching certain riders ride a race and you're frustrated and you just want to get out there on the horse and show them how it's done?
No, I never really got frustrated watching them. I mean, always wondering, what are you thinking? Coming from the old school and, everybody talked about, we had those derbies. We talked about Calvin Burrell, and they called him Bo Rail. Well, there was a whole generation of us, and probably before that, that was always ingrained. You stay close to the fence, you ride the rail, and that's the shortest way around there. And even today, you still watch riders that they're leaving more space in between each other. Where it doesn't seem like the race riding is the same as it used to be. It wasn't. It's not as it's tight. You used to be able to, you go out there and you got boots with somebody all the way around the racetrack. Today, you can put an extra horse in between people. And it just, that part's a little disappointing. What are they thinking? But, times change.
Well, eventually, Eddie, you decided to be a steward. And what was the process for that for you?
Well, I went through the Stewards Accreditation Program, just like most of them. They require you to do that nowadays. And in fact, I went with Tony Black and Mario Virgi. We all shared a place in Vent, Louisiana, and spent our week out there and went through the course and, took the test and everything that's required. And then it took me a while before I got that job. I ended up working in Iowa for a while as a clerk of scales over at Prairie Meadows. That was okay. I enjoyed that. Being in the jocks room and there's that camaraderie there, you kind of get around it. It's fun. And then end up getting an offer to go to work as a third-party pipeline inspector for a company called Avery Pipeline Services. So I quit my job as a clerk of scales and went and did that for about 3 years. But then, like everything, you know, the pipelines weren't going in the ground. And so I just happened to put my application into New Mexico. And if that was the first year that Izzy Trejo was the executive director. Anyway, he picked up my resume out of the ones that were there, and we had a discussion and, you know, kind of understood who I was and what I expect from a job. And they gave me the job, so I went and did that all last year in 16. It was a lot of fun. I found out they're really good at listening to people, and, you know, you never lose the eye that you have for racing, so that part was easy. And then, but just the listening part and trying to decipher exactly what people are saying to you, you know, it's, and they're never as direct as you would like them to be.
Eddie, were you the only jockey on the board of stewards there in New Mexico?
Well, you know, New Mexico's got one racetrack one at a time, but there was another one, Linda Salinas, which I don't think Linda ever got to ride a whole bunch, at least I don't remember her, but she was an ex-rider. Mm-hmm. And Linda, she's quite a bit older than I am. But then, you know, down south, we had Pinky Smith. Mm-hmm. She was at Ruidoso and Sunland Park. And, so there was riders down south.
But that definitely has to be an advantage for you as a former rider, then turned steward. You know exactly what's going on there. That had to be a really big benefit to them.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, somebody's always got a line of bull. I mean, being a rider, you know, you can look them square in the face, but, you know, you've got to get real about the whole thing. And they tend not to give you so much bull if they know you've achieved road races, and especially had a decent career.
Eddie, we only got about a minute left. Tell us what you're doing now.
Well, right now I'm laid off. You know, it's wintertime, and say I'm a third-party pipeline inspector, so it just happens to be that time of year when not a lot's going on. But that's basically what I do nowadays. Pipeline construction and yard construction. There's just all different aspects to what goes in the ground or above ground, whether it be water or energy, you know, which that's what I'm into is the energy department now, the energy aspects of pipelines.
Well,
so
Eddie,
when I'm working, I'm out in the field.
Eddie, we are all out of time, but it has been such a pleasure spending the last hour with you, hearing your stories. Wishing you all the best, Eddie, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks, Christina. Enjoy it.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. While you are there, check out all of the other great shows you can find here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, like Trainer Talk, Equine Forum, and of course, Express Bet Radio. Join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Della Pina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.